So today I would like to tell you about some work we've been doing in Berkeley with Daniel Parker, who's a grad student there, Xiangyu Cao, another postdoc, Alex Avdoshkin, a grad student, and then Ehud Altman, professor. And so the paper is on archive, and it will soon appear in PhysRevX. So as a way of introducing the topic, so today I'll talk about quantum dynamics. And I guess the kind of questions we have in mind, the kind of setup we have in mind is, you can imagine you have n qubits, and you start them in some product state that is very low entanglement, so it's very easy to encode that state. And then you time evolve it under some unitary dynamics with some Hamiltonian. And of course, the state becomes more and more entangled, so it becomes more and more complicated to actually represent that state. But then if you wait long enough, you would expect some kind of thermalization, at least locally. And then if there are some conserved quantities, you should be able to use some hydrodynamic description for that system. And so at longer times, actually, we expect that it should actually become fairly simple. And then, of course, there are interesting questions about both short times, long times, and also how to stitch these two together. So that's just like a broad introduction. And in particular, what I would like to talk about is operator dynamics. So the idea is to start with a simple operator to time evolve it under unitary evolution. And then it's going to become more and more complex. And the idea is to quantify that and to understand what's going to happen. And there are different quantities we can ask questions about this operator, like its size, for example, and the so-called out-of-time ordered correlators. Then there are different ways of defining how complex that operator is. And then at long times, you can also expect some hydrodynamics emerging, and we can ask what are the corresponding diffusion constants. Right, so so I guess there's been a lot of recent progress recently. Here I'm highlighting two of them. So one set of models that have been studied a lot are these random unitary networks, where again one starts with a product state and one applies a set of unitary operators that are drawn randomly. And there are lots of very interesting results about these systems. The only slightly annoying thing is that these unitary are actually taken randomly, so they do not actually correspond to time evolution under a given Hamiltonian. And then on the other hand, there are some SYK-like models, so SYK is for Sachdevier and Kitaev. So these models are non-local, so let's say you have n fermions and they all interact with each other with some random disordered couplings between all sets of four fermions. And so the interesting thing about these systems is that actually this is a Hamiltonian system, and actually they are well-defined Lyapunov exponent corresponding to chaos, and there are also some connections to energy transport. But the annoying thing is that these systems are a bit artificial in the sense that they don't have any locality, and they typically require a large n, so a large number of fermions. Okay, so basically instead, so today we will really try to actually study cases that actually have a Hamiltonian, but that are not always, that don't have to be this kind of non-local system. Right? So, so the idea is to formulate a hypothesis on some universal properties on how the complexity of operators grows over time under Hamiltonian dynamics. So we will go through a bit of formalism first and formulate the hypothesis, and then we will see, I'll show some evidence for this hypothesis, and then we'll show that actually there's some, at least two applications, one of them as in relation to quantum chaos, and another one in relation as a potential computational approach to study, for example, transport coefficients in quantum systems. Okay, so just to be concrete, so I will mostly have in mind systems where you have basically qubits, so like spin one, like a quantum Ising chain, for example, and so the idea is that you know, let's say I start with a simple operator, let's say, you know, the sigma x on the first side, and my Hamiltonian is, you know, this this Ising chain, which for which, you know, the coefficients are chosen so that actually it's away from integrable points, so we actually expect the behavior to be generic. And then you can start time evolving your operator, and you can make some expansion like this of e to the minus iht. And then of course you will see that the operators that appear will become more and more complicated by successive application of the commutation with h on the initial operator. So here is an example, for example, you know. So you'll get a large linear combination of strings of Pauli on the chain. And so this graph is supposed to represent the fact that, you know, by successive application of H, you really generate more and more of these terms. And so one of the goals will actually be to try and understand exactly how to quantify, if you want, this growth of complexity. So first of all, I'm going to go through a bit of notation. So we will work in the space of operators, but we will actually work in the space of operators as if we were actually doing working with states. So which means that when I use rounded kets like this, it actually means an operator that is understood as a vector in the space of operators. And so here is an example, for example, where you have, you know, a linear combination of two strings of Paulis. And then the inner product in that space of operators, so for now we work at infinite temperature. So then the inner product that we choose is really taking this trace of A dagger B divided by the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay, and then the Liouvillian is a super operator that generalizes the Hamiltonian. Okay, so the Liouvillian basically it's just commutation with H. Okay, and we call it curly L. And so this Liouvillian is called a super operator because it's an operator that is applied on other operators. And then time evolution really just becomes just like time dependent quantum mechanics, except that instead of a ket psi, we have ket O, and instead of the Hamiltonian, we have the Liouvillian. Okay? And then the solution is just applying e to the I LT on the initial operator O. Okay, so I guess this was just notation, but it should be useful afterwards. Okay, so then what we propose to do is to basically use the Lanczos algorithm on this simple operator O that we start from. So basically the idea is that you construct a set of states by applying the Liouvillian repeatedly on your initial operator. Okay? So, and you do this n times, so you get n states. And then, of course, they are not orthonormal, but then you use a Gram-Schmidt on them, and then that gives you a set of orthonormal operators that I call On. Okay? Now, what's interesting is that in that basis of the ONs, then the Liouvillian has this tri-diagonal form, right? So it just...
I'm sorry. It was just a quick question. What is the reason that the diagonal is zero?
I mean, as long as O is Hermitian, then I think you can show that the diagonal has to be zero.
The operator is always
zero. When you start from O, mm-hmm. That is, I think, yeah. And so basically you get this hopping problem, right? So it's really, it really becomes like a hopping problem in a semi-infinite chain. Okay, where the operator at time t equals zero would start exactly on the first site, and then over time it would actually propagate down the chain. Okay, and basically once you do that, then the only question is really what are these b's? What are these hopping matrix elements? Right. So then if you know the b's, then you can actually solve the thing. But of course, I mean that sounds simple, but in practice you always have to truncate at some point, and that truncation is really actually the crux of the problem. And we'll come back to that. But if you really have an infinite size system, you can keep doing this forever, and you expect that at some point the behavior of the bees will have some asymptotic behavior, and then the hope is that actually, basically each different asymptotic behavior for the bees will correspond to a different regime of dynamics. Okay, and so so actually, you know, this led Mathis in the talk to actually say that this is a way of reducing practically any problem to one dimension. But of course, in practice, the point is that actually constructing these Bs is actually very hard. And then there is also the problem of truncation that is very complicated. Yeah.
So is your matrix three-diagonal because you even your Hamiltonian to be like two local, or is
No. That's true for any Hamiltonian. That's just by definition, right? Because you know the, my basis vectors here, they're actually derived from these LN applied modules.
Generically, these Bs are complex? Or?
No, real and positive.
Oh, they're real positive, okay.
Are there any relation to the Bs and the spectrum of the derivative?
Sorry, what?
Are there any relation between the Bs and the spectrum of the derivative?
So the spectrum of the Liouvillian is given by all the differences between energies of the Hamiltonian. Right. So the Liouvillian is n squared by n squared dimensional, and the spectrum is really Ei minus Ej, where the Es are the energies. There's no simple
So first of all, the product of all the Bs should be equal to the determinant of this matrix, which is determinant of the derivative in some sense.
Two operators are equivalent. So this is constructing a representation of the original operator in a certain basis.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the spectrum. I'm wondering.
So the spectrum of this should be the spectrum of the original.
Yeah, the spectrum of this, I mean, before truncation, right, if you actually construct it like fully, right, then the spectrum of the Liouvillian, you know, doesn't depend on the basis. It's just all the differences in energies of the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, but is there any simple relation between the Bs and the spectrums?
I don't think so.
Or the behavior of Bs.
So I think what you're referring to is that, I mean, if it was fully tri-diagonal, if it was upper triangular, then I would agree. You're saying that the product of all the Bs is equal to what?
So the intuition is that the B is pretty close to the diagonals.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just wondering whether we can talk.
Well, I mean, we'll see a few relations between, like, we'll see actually how to compute the Bs and how they are related to different properties of the system. But there is no, like, straightforward simple relations between,
Question? Those Bs depend on O?
Yes.
Then should I expect any relation between Bs and L without specifying O?
So the point is that, so that's part of the hypothesis, but what we observe in practice is that if you look at a typical set of Bs, they have some transient for the first few coefficients, but then they reach some asymptotic behavior. And that behavior seems to be independent of the initial operator that you chose. Of course, I'm excluding special cases like if you take an operator that commutes to the Hamiltonian or if there is some special symmetry or something. Right? But if you take a generic operator, a generic simple operator, then empirically it looks like the large N behavior of the Bs is independent of the operator you chose.
Usually choose O to be local?
Yeah. So the idea is to start with a simple operator and to watch its complexity grow. So typically we take it local.
You just said the coefficient will be real and positive. Is that under the assumption that O is Hermitian?
Yeah. Let's take O Hermitian. Yeah. Okay. So now. So now we went to basically this basis. To this basis, right? So basically the idea is that now if you're on the position down the chain, I will think of as some measure of complexity. Right? So the idea is that because basically you know the operate like basically for example this guy, right? So it will have it will include a linear combination of for example, you know, when you have commuted your initial operator with the Hamiltonian three times, and then four times, five times, and so on, right? So basically, the idea is that the complexity of the operators will actually grow as you move down the chain. And okay, so now Let's see. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So again, so one can actually, you know, look at this 1D quantum mechanics problem and solve it and you know, and study like the time evolution of the operator wave function in that Krylov basis. And then from this, there are two interesting quantities. The first one is the actual autocorrelation function of the operator, which just becomes the amplitude of the wave function on the first side. Okay, so basically, if you want to know what is the autocorrelation function from this, you just need to look at how much of the weight is still on the first side. And then another one that we call k complexity is basically to look at the position, the average position down the chain. So the expectation of n of t. Okay. Okay. So now basically the question is what do the b's typically look like, right? So and so here is three different typical examples. So in free model you can show that basically, you know, if you start with a simple operator, it's actually, you know, after a few commutations, actually the b's will actually saturate. So they actually stop growing with n at some point. So that but you know, that's very specific case on free case. Okay, and I guess the point I want to focus on is really the what I call chaotic or at least like non-integrable case, where it looks like the generic behavior is really that asymptotically the b's actually grow linearly with the site index with n. Okay.
Very naive question. So freeism is also integrable. So why is it different?
So what I mean is that, you know, here it's like non-free integrable. Let's say xxz. And here it's free xx chain. That's what I mean. So here it's interacting integrable.
Yeah.
And here it's free integrable.
Thank you. Tune the curves continuously from one to the other.
Or you mean when you change some, when you add some integrability breaking perturbation and so on?
Yeah,
or
the z term.
There will be some plot about that afterwards. But basically, the idea is that typically what happens is, well, maybe I'll go back to it when I have a plot where I can show. But the idea is that as soon as you add a tiny bit of a perturbation, basically like the large n behavior becomes chaotic. So you know, you might have. I think it's better if I show it when I have the plot.
So what is the operator? What's OE?
Oh, okay. So well, actually, it's written here. So in the free case, that's probably just, I don't know if it's, I don't remember if it's sigma z or sigma x, one of the two. Well, actually, it's free in the, maybe probably sigma z, so that it's also local in terms of the fermions. Here it's sigma, well, I guess here it's xxx, so it doesn't matter, you can pick any, so it's just like, yeah.
But say, let's say you define easing as zz plus x, and you said that that free is actually you take z. Like basically the one that mapped to a local in free.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so basically what I'm, yeah, I mean, what I mean here is that, let's say you actually, didn't use spins but use fermions, okay? Then any local operator would have had this property. But you know, but there is this extra complication. If you actually look at xx, it's only free once you go to fermions. So then it, but being, yeah. But I mean, at the end of the day, I really want to focus on the non-integrable case. And actually, we don't have any claim or about like universal behavior for integrable cases, and we haven't really focused on that. I mean, it's an interesting question, but. So today I really want to focus on actually the generic, like non-integrable case.
I just want to make sure. So do you call Lattice integrable?
Sorry, what?
Do you call Lattice integrable?
Lattice liquid? Well, which microscopic model? XXZ, yes.
Okay, then suppose I tune the Lattice parameter. Is the power always 1/2 in that curve?
Is what? You mean the square root here?
Yeah.
The square root it's got nothing to do with critical exponents of the CFT or anything. That's not related to that. No, the square root is possible to understand from accounting arguments that I can go over afterwards if you're interested. But it's not related to any kind of critical exponents.
I think you're just asking, is the 1/2 property of the entire XXZ phase diagram for finite SZ, for the finite JZ?
I mean, this 1/2, Basically, you know, we only have numerical evidence for it, and some arguments as to why it should be one half. But you know, we, it's not like we have some extensive study of it. So I wouldn't really, you know, stick my neck out about that. Yeah. Okay. So right. So I guess the hypothesis is really that in non-integrable cases, the asymptotic behavior of the bees is really linear in N. Okay? So for example, these, so this curve was actually obtained for the SYK model. And SYK model is quite special because actually the, you know, it's basically very linear from the start. And we will show afterwards, here is some other kind of numerics where we actually, so we computed the first 30 coefficients for different non-integrable Ising quantum chains. That's just different set of parameters. And I guess, yeah, so the idea is that, you know, after, so there is a transient, but afterwards it looks pretty linear. As you can see, SYK is linear from the start, while these have a more complicated behavior. So what you were asking about non-interacting and weakly interacting, so basically, you know, here, this x, you know, at hx equals zero, you actually have a non-interacting model, and then as soon as you apply a bit of hx, as you can see, you know, basically after a while, it also becomes linear, right? So basically, the idea is that, you know, we'll work under the assumption that for the generic case, the Bs actually grow linearly with n. And then the evidence is numerical, also analytical in the case of SYK. So actually, in the case of SYK, in the large Q limit, we can actually compute these Bs explicitly, analytically. And they have this special form, which indeed in the large n limit becomes linear in n. Interestingly, for this very specific formula for the Bs, one can actually solve the corresponding dynamics, you know, down the 1D chain, like also exactly. There was an exact solution for what the wave functions look like for this very specific set of Bs. So interestingly, linear growth for the Bs is actually the fastest growth possible. So basically, the hypothesis is really that these coefficients basically grow as fast as they can. Okay. So here is a sketch of the proof that shows that the linear growth is the fastest growth possible for these coefficients. So let me first actually compute this. So this is just, you know, the norm squared of the operator that I get by applying the Liouvillian n times on my initial operator. Okay, so I can rewrite it in this form. And now this thing, you can think of it as, you know, if you actually write out explicitly all the sums inside the L operators, it's going to be like a sum of hopping histories where you start from the initial operator O, and then every time you go through a L, you do a hop either to the left or to the right, and you do that 2n times, but then you need to come back to the initial operator, right? And every time you do that, that basically gives you like one term if I expand this sum, okay? So basically, this sum can actually be mapped to this dig path of 2n steps where you start from the initial operator and then you do hops like this and then you have to come back to yourself. And you know, every time you do a hop, you get the corresponding B factor in the term, okay? So now this sum in particular will have one term that's special. It's the term where actually you have the pyramid like this, right? Where you hop all the way to the n site and then you come back, okay? And that guy will have this amplitude, right? Because each hop will have been done twice, like one to go forward and one to go backwards. So basically then you can show that this product of the b squared is smaller than this guy, because basically this is just a sum of squares of which one term is actually this guy. If that makes sense? Does it? Okay. And but now the point is that actually this guy can be also bounded by looking at some combinatorics, by actually, you know, thinking about what does this vector look like when you apply the Liouville n times on a given initial small operator, like simple operator, right? So the idea is that, you know, if your Hamiltonian is k-local, every time you commute your operator with h, you're going to get, you know, a finite number of new operators that pop up. And then if you apply it again, for each of these operators, you will get another set of these computational relations giving you new operators. And basically, you can convince yourself that this combinatorics shows you that at most, this thing will actually grow like factorial n factorial squared. So the idea is that basically, you know, you can easily see that basically this vector will be a linear combination of essentially n factorial string of Paulis. And then if you take the norm of that, well, you can bound it by just that number. So that's how you get that it's smaller than n factorial squared. But basically the point is that if this product must be smaller than this, then that must mean that basically the b's have to be smaller than some constant times n. So that's one way to see that this linear growth is actually the fastest one possible. Okay, so basically, yeah.
So then you use
k local. Actually, the argument works also for k local Hamiltonian. You need to modify it slightly, but it works also for k local Hamiltonian. So it works for SYK in the same way.
Yeah.
That's what I mean, yeah, Q local. Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, the point is that if the B's grow.
Just assume that BN is some for the polynomial of N.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so then assuming now that the hoppings grow linearly with N, we can ask what does that imply? And so then we can actually solve the dynamics down this chain with these hoppings. And then you can take a continuum limit. So as I said, there are actually certain specific, one can actually basically solve exactly this problem when the hoppings are linear. But here I'm just giving you the sketch of the proof to give you a more physical insight. So basically, there's a quick and early way of doing it where basically you just assume a continuum limit where you replace n by some continuous x spatial coordinate, and then you end up with this ODE where basically you can solve it with the method of the characteristics, and these characteristics they grow exponentially in time, which means that your wave function is actually transported exponentially fast down the chain. Or in other words, the expectation value of the position down the chain grows like e to the 2 alpha t. Okay? And so that's why alpha is important, because actually it gives you the rate of growth of this Krylov complexity that we've defined. And so here is an example of the wave function. It's a function of n for different times. And you can see here it's a log scale. So indeed, actually, the n actually grows exponentially in time. Okay? So what's interesting here is that if you want, it's quite rare to find something that grows exponentially in time in a quantum system, in a generic quantum system, right? Because we will talk about OTOCs afterwards, but OTOCs, they grow exponentially in time only in these SYK-like models that are non-local, right? So in local quantum systems, it's actually very unusual to find something that grows exponentially in time. And so I'll come back to that. Right.
This exponential growth, that's late time behavior?
That's short time behavior.
That's short time.
Yeah, I'd say. Short time in a sense that, I mean, basically here, what I mean by short time is, for an infinite size system, so this would go on forever. But actually, for a finite size system, at some point, your hoppings would actually saturate as well. The Bs would saturate. They cannot go linearly forever. They would actually saturate. And there, you know, there's clearly something drastic would happen, and N of T would start, you know, to. But you know, we haven't really, we focused only on infinite size systems so far. But it would be interesting to ask exactly what happens for a finite size system once you reach that step.
So for infinite size, this goes on forever.
Yeah.
But I would think, say, if you just have this new real dynamics in a short time, I can probably just expand this new real dynamics to say T to the, I mean, first order and second order. And in that case, isn't the small n dominant the short time behavior instead of large n of B?
Right. So, I see what you mean. I guess it's true that, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah. So in that case, but the point, yeah, I see. I guess that's right. So it's more like, yeah, okay. So they could be a short time transient. I agree. Before your wave function actually starts populating, you know, the place down the chain where the Bs actually start becoming linear. Is that your point? Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So this is more like some intermediate.
It's intermediate time behavior, I guess. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now. Let's see. Yeah. So now we'd like to establish a relation with chaos. Okay, so classical chaos, of course, is a very like universal phenomenon that appears in any kind of nonlinear classical system, and so it corresponds to this sensitivity to initial conditions, and that can be measured by looking at these kinds of observables. And so by rewriting this as a Poisson bracket relation, then there's a natural quantum version of this, which is this OTOC, which in this case, I decide to write in this form. So the kind of OTOCs I will have in mind will be basically I'm looking at, you can rewrite it in this form where, let's say, the VJs are actually simple on-site operators, and then you just look at the norm squared of the commutator between your operator at time t and these simple operators VJ. Okay, and then of course, and then the idea is that there are some special cases, like specific systems in which actually this OTOC grows exponentially in the same fashion as this grows exponentially in classical systems. And so just to have like a comparison between different kinds of systems, so in classical systems, we do have a well-defined Lyapunov exponent, and chaos is well established. And then you have these non-local quantum models called SYK-like, which have also been shown to have an OTOC that goes exponentially in time. And then you have local quantum systems, let's say like a spin chain or also in higher dimensions, where generically OTOCs do not grow exponentially in time. They have some complicated behavior, but basically like they do not grow exponentially in time. And basically there's one way to understand it by just, because basically a simple example of an OTOC is actually measuring the size of the operator. And by size of the operator, I really mean for a given Pauli string, I count how many Paulis are not identity, and that's my size. Well, then if you look at the average size of your operator over time, basically that corresponds to an OTOC. But in local quantum systems, because of Lieb-Robinson bounds, actually there's no way that this could grow exponentially in time. And so in that sense, quantum chaos is understood as this exponential in time behavior is not something that happens in these local quantum systems. But on the other hand, the growth of this complexity with the rate alpha actually happens, in the same way in these three systems. So we can also define it in the classical system, in the whole thing. The whole formalism just carries over. But I guess the interesting thing is that, first of all, now we actually have a rate that is well-defined also in this case, that is physically probably the most interesting one. And so alpha, if you want, I think is a useful measure of complexity growth in that is completely generic and that works also in this case. And on top of that, in these two cases, since we have two different exponential growth, we can compare them and ask, you know, whether there can be some relation between them. Yeah.
For the classical system, I thought for the quantum systems, you need to have a lattice to do this. But for classical system, what's the analog of lattice?
So in the classical system, an example is, let's say you have a single classical rotor with whose Hamiltonian is nonlinear, right? So let's say H equals SZ squared plus SX or something. And then you add like nonlinearities, or you have let's say two rotors so that it's not integrable. You have two rotors that are nonlinear, right? So then if you want, the equivalent of the lattice is actually the spherical harmonics, right? Because for a classical spin, you know, the space of operators, you know, on for any given spin, the space of operators is actually infinite because you can go to arbitrarily high spherical harmonics, right? So then you can think of that a ladder of spherical harmonics as your chain. Not as the Krylov chain, but you can think of that as if you're on the lattice in the quantum case. Okay? And then, you know, measuring operator size in the quantum case, which is really measuring, you know, how many non-identities do you have in my string of Paulis, that corresponds to basically measuring how high you are in this ladder of spherical harmonics. Because, and that's also a good measure of complexity, because if you think of it as just a function of phase space, you know, if you go to higher spherical harmonics, you really go to more and more complicated functions of phase space. Right? So that's the way in which it carries over. Okay, so then we are putting forward this bound on chaos at infinite temperature, where the idea, actually the Lyapunov exponent, when it's well defined, is smaller or equal than 2 alpha. Okay, so first of all, some empirical evidence. So we can compute it for SYK again. So for SYK, here is a table where we computed alpha, basically semi-analytically, it's possible to compute it for different values of Q. And then the Lyapunov exponent is also known or can also be computed in the infinite temperature limit. And as you can see, you know, I guess at large Q, they actually become equal. But at smaller Q, actually, you know, lambda is always slightly smaller than lambda over 2 is always slightly smaller than alpha. So that's the first piece of evidence. And then here, we also computed, we compared alpha and lambda over 2 for exactly what I described. So a classical two-spin model that is actually, you know, kind of like a toy model for classical chaos, and where there is some parameter C that we can tune to basically, you know, go towards two different kinds of kind of trivial points where the Lyapunov goes to zero. Anyway, so basically it's some parameter where both the Lyapunov and alpha change, and it looks like, you know, the bound is respected, and it even looks like it's actually, the bound is actually tight because there is this case where actually they become equal. Okay, so now actually for quantum systems, we actually have a proof that this is true, that lambda is smaller than 2 alpha. So basically, if you want, like, I'll just present the sketch of the proof, but the idea is that, you know, every time you apply the Liouvillian, the operator size can only grow by that much, right? By a finite amount, right? But then basically, you know, if you understand the OTOC as just basically measuring operator size at a given time, then you know that, you know, if you measure the OTOC for a given, you know, for the nth Lanczos vector, you can actually bound it by some constant times n, right? So basically, which means that you can also bound the OTOC at a given time by basically some constant times the position down the chain, right? N of t. So if n of t grows like e to the 2 alpha t, basically the and then I guess the point is that there's no way the OTOC can grow faster than the position down the Krylov chain. And therefore, you know, if both of them are exponential, then that just gives you an inequality between the two exponentials.
Where did you use infinite temperature?
I mean, the reason why I say it's infinite temperature, I mean, it, at a different, at a bunch of places actually. Basically, if you want to go to finite temperature, you need to define a new inner product. Okay, so you notice that every time I'm I've been computing a lot of norms of operators, right? So these norms correspond to an inner product where I'm just taking the trace of A dagger A, right? If you want to be at finite temperature, you need now to put the density matrix in the inside the matrix, inside the trace, right? The e to the minus beta h, right? And then there are different ways of doing that, and you know, because then there are different prescriptions on where to put this e to the minus beta h, and they actually lead to different results. So basically, the finite temperature case is a bit more subtle, and I will I will get to it soon. But that's why I'm saying at infinite temperature, because basically so far, you know, I've been using this infinite temperature in a product.
What's the meaning of OT, OC, this ON?
So basically, you know, you can think of it as, So that's something that, because I didn't want to go through too many details of the proof. Basically, the idea is that you can write the OTOC as a super operator, okay? Such that basically, then you compute the expectation. You see what I mean, yeah? And then you compute its expectation value with ON, and then you get an yeah. Okay, so now actually, so that's the finite temperature story. So, yeah, so basically, so if you want the whole Lanczos formalism carries over to finite temperature, but the only thing is that you need to choose an inner product. And basically, once you choose it, then you know you everything is well defined, and you get a value for alpha and so on. But that value for alpha that you get, for example, or even the values of the b's, right? So that will depend on which inner product you chose. Okay, which makes sense because depending on the inner product you chose, you would also get a different autocorrelation function, for example, right? So C of t also, you know, at finite temperature, the autocorrelation function depends on which inner product you chose. And so, you know, I guess the standard one in for linear response would be something like this, where I is just e to the minus h. But then in high energy, people tend to use this one. So sometimes it's called the regularized one, where you split your e to the minus beta h into two, right? So you put one here and one there, okay? And so what we did is that we have a conjecture about finite t. So in this case, we don't have a proof, but our conjecture is that the Lyapunov exponent at a given temperature is bounded by two alpha t, where this alpha is computed with the Whiteman inner product, okay? This one. But interestingly, you can show easily that 2 alpha t Whiteman is smaller than 2 pi t, and which is actually the Maldacena, Schenker, and Stanford bound. Okay? So basically the idea is that our conjecture is actually tighter than the bound. And so then here is an example. So the reason why we made that conjecture is that we computed these different quantities for the large Q SYK model. So the blue line is the Lyapunov exponent versus temperature. And then the red circles is the value of 2 alpha defined in this way with the Whiteman inner product. And as you can see, it's basically like it's tight. And then the green line is the Maldacena, Schenker, and Stanford bound, right? Which is just a straight line because it just goes like T, right? And so basically, you know, you can see that they agree at small temperature, but then at higher temperature, our bound is tighter than the Maldacena, Schenker, and Stanford one, and it seems to actually to be tight with the actual value of the Lyapunov exponent. So basically, at infinite temperature, we have proven that this is true, and then at finite temperature, our conjecture is that this is true. Okay, so yeah, and then at small temperature, basically the two bounds agree. The two bounds give the same thing. All right. Okay, so now for the remainder of the talk, I'll talk about.
Can you also prove that t goes to 0 r by t goes to 2 pi t?
Sorry, yeah, actually what I meant here, you're right. So this is proven, but then actually this does not have so this does not have to be tight for any model. So in other words, this probably generically I would expect that there are some models where this thing, even at low t, this thing is smaller than 2 pi t. Yeah. So even at low temperature, this conjecture bound is tighter than the Madison Schenker and Stanford bound.
Better just make sure when you say the upper exponent here, you also define it in the way you would regulate any equation to define.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, basically, yes. Yeah.
If you change to another regulator, does the proof go?
Well, okay, so here at finite temperature, we don't have a proof anyway, right? So this is just a conjecture. So basically, even here, I guess I don't even know if there is an agreement in literature on whether the Lyapunov exponent does or not depend on the regularization. Okay, so in that sense, it's hard to really make a statement about that. For the remainder of the talk, I'll talk about how it might be actually able to use this to actually do some computation, like for example, some diffusion constants. So first of all, something that I should mention is that alpha actually appears in linear response. So if you're on, it's really related to a two-point function. So in that sense, alpha is a much simpler and straightforward quantity than lambda, right? Because alpha actually, you can get it from a two-point function, and in the following way. So basically, you can show that. So here is your autocorrelation function. You can take its Fourier transform, and then you can show this. So this is kind of this is a mathematical result that if the b's go linearly with n, then the high frequency tail of the spectral function must decay exponentially with the rate that's given by alpha. Okay, so if you're on the intuition here is that one interesting thing here is that actually these exponential tails in the spectral function, they can actually be measured in NMR. For like nuclear spins in insulators, and actually they have been reported to be exponential, right? So people can actually extract this rate. So alpha in principle is actually a measurable quantity that you can actually measure by basically getting the spectral function and looking at high frequency. Okay, so that's just an aside, but I guess the main point here is that. What we are doing is really looking at high frequency behavior, essentially, right? And the idea is really that there is some universality at high frequency. But now we would like to look at hydrodynamics with this. So the idea is, what if our operator is actually just some density wave of some sort, and then you want to watch it relax and get a relaxation rate and then fit it with a d to the momentum squared, and then get a diffusion constant. Okay, so that would be nice. But then, of course, the point is that, as I've said, the hypothesis is really something about high frequency behavior, and there's no reason why that high frequency behavior should tell us something about the long time behavior of the operator, right? And hydrodynamics is really about this long time behavior, right? And so that's why that's why we really have to be cautious here. And there's no reason why, just by using the hypothesis, we should actually get a handle on hydrodynamics. And just an example to show you that that's true, right? So here are two different autocorrelation functions, so that are very different because this one at long times has a power law behavior, and this one at long times has an exponential behavior, but they both have a spectral function that decays exponentially at large frequencies. And therefore, actually, they both have linearly growing Langstroth coefficients. Okay, so that shows how, you know, you can have two different behaviors in terms of the long time dynamics that would have the same high frequency behavior. Okay, yeah.
Sorry, just on this exponential decay thing. Maybe following what Jacob asked before, since from the operator dynamics point of view, you have some transient, you may have some transient behavior at the original setting. Should I understand this relation as true when omega is large, but not so large that you start to probe the transient?
I mean, there's no, for an infinite size system, there's no upper limit in frequency. So it's not like, so, you know, I guess these tails, they go on forever. So there's no like upper limit in frequency.
But maybe I'm misunderstanding, because if omega is really large, you're probing some really short timescale.
That's right? Not exactly it, right? So it's not like you know, it's not, for example, like, to get high frequency response, you need to know C of T everywhere. It's not like you cannot just equate short time. Look, at short times, you know, C of T, like nothing happens, right? If you only look at very, very short time C of T, you know, like nothing's moving, right? So that doesn't mean that, so that's not related to high frequency. That's not like, you know, you cannot really equate the two. So, you know, there is short time, long times, and then there is low frequency, high frequency. But there's no, it's not like if you know one, you can deduce the other. But,
But somehow you have really this long, large frequency behavior with the O-talk, right?
We have related the high frequency behavior with
O-talk.
Well, at least we have bounded the O-talk with by something that is related to high frequency behavior. That's true.
The intermediate times behavior of.
Yeah, but the point is that for an infinite size system, an O-talk would grow exponentially forever.
Okay.
Right.
And in this case, there this. Exponential alpha t behavior stopped at some point. This Langstroth basis
for a finite size system, or
for
an infinite size system, the, you know, n of t goes like e to the 2 alpha t forever, and o talk goes like e to the lambda t forever.
Okay.
Both of them go like that forever.
So there's no like concept of like something analogous to scrambling time.
Well, I mean, for an infinite size system, you know, for an infinite size SYK, if n is actually infinite, then there's no scrambling time. Yeah, because the scrambling time goes like log n. So if n is infinite, then log n is infinite. Yeah.
But there is actually a parametric dependence on the system size and the scrambling time.
But yeah, well, it's the same thing here, actually. I mean, you know, because if n of t goes like e to the 2 alpha t, you would expect that basically if you do have finite size system, you would actually expect that the time after which your wave packet reaches this plateau of the B coefficients, you would expect that that time would also go like log n. In the same way. And that's basically because you would expect that plateau for small n, right? So for the Bn, such that small n becomes of the order of the system size. Okay, so then the proposed scheme is then to calculate numerically the first n b's, the first n Langstroth coefficients, and then you fit it, you extract the slope, and then the next ones, and then, you know, all the remaining ones, you just use that fit to choose them, right? So the idea is that, you know, you construct the first coefficients, so that are actually computed numerically at these black dots, and then you fit it, and then you assume that for the rest of all the n's, it will just keep going with that fit. But then if you have all the b's, then you can actually construct the Green's function by using this formula, okay? And And so then basically that's a proposal for a scheme where then you actually get the Green's function, and then you know if your operator was actually some density wave with some momentum q, then you can actually extract a diffusion constant by looking at the relaxation rate as a function of q, and then you can fit the q squared, and then you can extract a diffusion constant. But of course, there's no reason for this to work in general, right? Exactly for the reason that I've described. Because basically, if you want, the idea is that another way to say this is that you have this semi-infinite chain, okay? And basically, what we have shown is that the average position of your wave packet down this chain actually grows exponentially in time with the rate 2 alpha. But then, if you want to ask about long times, you need to ask how much rate is there still on the first site, okay? But that's actually a somewhat unrelated question, right? So you could imagine that n grows exponentially in time, but that this weight actually only decays, with a power law in time or exponentially, right? It's not clear. It's kind of two unrelated questions, okay? But nevertheless, one can still do these kinds of things, and if you see that, I guess the coefficients at least look pretty linear up to the point at which you can compute them exactly numerically, then you might be a bit more confident about your results. Anyway, so in the end, we end up with for this we did this for this quantumizing chain, and we ended up with this formula for the diffusion constant, and it seems to agree well with other methods. But again, this is so here is a summary. I think I'm out of time basically. So so basically the hypothesis is that these Langevin coefficients grow linearly in time, and that the corresponding rate is an interesting quantity that it tells you how a suitably defined complexity grows in time. And interestingly, this alpha is well defined in any generic model, so you don't need to be the large N or like a non-local model, so unlike the Lyapunov exponent. And when both exist, well, alpha bounds the Lyapunov. And something that I haven't mentioned is that there are actually log corrections in 1D. Log corrections, the Langevin coefficients, instead of growing like n, they grow like n over log n.
And does that modify this exponential behavior?
It becomes a stretch exponential, yeah. So there are some small differences like that, yeah. Okay, so I think I'll stop there.
This hypothesis, do you expect it to be derivable from random matrix theory?
That would be nice. To be honest, I feel like I don't know enough about random matrix theory to really see a clear way forward with that, with a proof like that. But it's possible.
Similar question. So for the chaotic system, it's believed that the operator entanglement should grow linearly in time.
Okay.
I was wondering, does that statement imply the linear growth of Langevin coefficients, or vice versa, maybe?
Operator entanglement defined in the way...
You just treat the operator as a state again,
yeah.
And you're looking at the bipartite entanglement.
I'm not sure if there's a direct relation like that. Actually, so there are some preliminary results where you do Langevin with MPOs. You start with a simple MPO and then you do Langevin, and then you look at how the bond dimension grows with n.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like the bond dimension is growing polynomially in n actually, which is unexpected. But I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe that's not directly related to your question. I guess you would need to relate. What we can say things about is really basically operator size.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure if there's a direct relation between operator size and operator entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not clear to me whether it's possible to say something about that, but maybe it is, I don't know.
But in a sense, this way of measuring this exponential growth is sort of basis dependent, in the sense that you have to do, use this quite low basis.
Yes.
And well, but I guess ideally that you probably want some measurement that's independent of the basis.
Yeah, but you'll notice that a very simple, I mean, an equivalent way of measuring this phenomenon is just to look at the high frequency tail of the spectral function.
Uh-huh.
And if it decays exponentially,
okay,
then you can extract a rate, and that's alpha.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, in that sense, you know, the Krylov basis, you know, is interesting to talk about complexity and so on. But, you know, a more straightforward way of thinking about things is actually to look at the spectral function and to look at the tail. And actually, interestingly, I realized afterwards that in the literature, for a lot of, in classical chaos systems, actually people have been looking for exponential tails in spectral function as a proxy for chaos, because that's much easier to measure than a Lyapunov exponent. So in that sense, you know, alpha is, I see your point. But I think the idea is that, you know, for local systems, if you look at operator size or OTOC, then they don't grow exponentially in time. And then if you want, but then, you know, I guess there is this special basis that you can construct, right, based on that initial operator, in which actually the wave packet, if you want, grows exponentially in time. And it sounds basis dependent, but in the end of the day, you know, it's related to some fairly simple properties of the spectral function. So, you know, it's not like, it's not that far-fetched in that way.
Okay, let's thank Thomas again.